Well, some of it I do because I find it intellectually challenging and exciting and demanding. And some of it I do because I just feel it has to be done. So, you know, people are suffering bitterly throughout the world. There are a lot of things we can do about it. And that seems to me a responsibility that comes with privilege and freedom, which we have to an unusual degree, maybe unique degree, to involve ourselves in these issues.
What do you think of the United States?
Well, I think it's a complicated country. It has wonderful achievements. It's in some domains, it's gone beyond any other country in the world. Protection for freedom of speech, for example, many other liberties. It's got tremendous advantages, incomparable. Had the biggest economy in the world over a century ago. I don't think it's used them properly. There's plenty of many of the actions that the U.S. government has taken in the world, I think, are deplorable and should be stopped and reversed. It's you can't really comment on a country. There's just too many facets to it. There's a society, there's a culture, there's just too many things. I mean, when I take my grandson to a baseball game, as I did last Sunday, I enjoy being part of mainstream America. When I look at U.S. government foreign policy or the domestic, highly regressive domestic policies, I'm extremely critical.
Noam Chomsky will be with us for just a little under 3 hours, and we will go to the phones in the next several minutes. But for the first part of this program, we want to chat a bit about his life. Philadelphia played a big role in your life. What year were you born?
I was born in 1928 in Philadelphia, immigrant, first-generation immigrant family, Jewish. My parents were very much involved, in fact, immersed in the Jewish community, Hebrew culture. My father was a Hebrew scholar, ran the Hebrew school systems. My mother taught in it, deeply committed to Zionism. We have to remember that that was something different then from what it is today. Actually, I grew up in a community which, in which we were, for most of the time, the only Jewish family in a mostly German and Irish Catholic community, and there were a lot of problems, which incidentally my parents never knew about, but the streets were complicated places.
Problems for you that they never knew? Give us an example.
Well, as I say, there was a lot of anti-Semitism in those. This is the 1930s, deeply anti-Semitic period. I don't like to say it, but I grew up with a kind of a visceral fear of Catholics. I knew it was irrational, and got over it, but it was just the street experience. There were periods during these were periods of complex ethnic conflicts in the cities. There were times when I was a young teenager where in Philadelphia there was a curfew, I think a 7 or 8 o'clock curfew on teenagers. If we wanted to go out in the evening, we had to have parental authority. There were times when the walk from the subway station to the Hebrew school was under police guard. And it wasn't just Jews were not... You know, there was a lot of anti-Semitism, but it went in all directions. Actually, you get a pretty good picture of it from some of the novels written about the period describing urban ethnic conflicts, which are complicated and real. Grew up in the middle of them.
Where had your parents come from, and what were they like?
My father had come from Ukraine right before the First World War, escaping the Tsarist army. My mother had come from what's now Belarus, her family. She came when she was a baby, actually. But and the two families were were first-generation immigrant families.
What were they like? What were your parents like?
Well, I had a very warm, loving childhood. I look back at it with a lot of warmth and affection. They were both working. They taught Hebrew school, so I was in school, actually, from all day, from the time I was about a year and a half old. I was actually in early years up to high school in an experimental school that was run by Temple University, a Deweyite school. Wonderful place. I don't know if there's anything like it today. It fostered creative activity. There was no competition. Actually, I didn't know I was a good student until I got to high school, because the question never arose. You know, you weren't graded by your achievements. I mean, I knew I skipped a class, but I didn't think anything particular of it, and nor did anyone else. It was a very healthy, exciting intellectual and social environment.
Why did you decide to go to the University of Pennsylvania, where you got, I believe, your undergraduate, your master's, and your PhD?
Question never arose. You didn't go in. The idea of leaving home was inconceivable. We were working students, both my wife and I. You lived at home, you went to the local school, worked in the afternoons. The concept of going away to college just didn't exist. The question never came up.
When did you first get interested in linguistics?
That was sort of accident. Well, it's complicated. Actually, my father was a Hebrew scholar. He did work on medieval Hebrew grammar. And growing up as a child, I read his manuscripts and drafts of the book and so on. And I was kind of intrigued by it. Then I happened to, through political context, to meet Zelig Harris, who I later discovered was the most important and influential linguist in the country. He happened to be teaching at the University of Pennsylvania. I was actually on the verge of dropping out of college at that time. I was pretty bored with it. I got in at 16, and a lot of anticipation and excitement, and was mostly killed in the first year. And I was not really committed to staying. I met him, and he drew me back into college. I suspect in retrospect that he was doing it on purpose, but I don't know. Anyhow, I started taking his graduate courses, and through his influence, also mostly graduate courses in other fields. And he was an extremely brilliant and exciting person in many respects. And my interests developed through those contacts and then on from there.
When did you meet your wife, Carol?
She was about 2 years old, and I was about 4 years old, I guess. These were closely knit communities. She was also from a Jewish community. Her father and mother were from European immigrants, and the families knew each other, and we had sort of met as children, and they went through a kind of similar history, Hebrew schools, Hebrew camps. By the time we were teenagers, we interacted in a different fashion. We married pretty young. She was 19. I had just turned 21.
There are people that say there are two Noam Chomskys, as you know, the linguist and the political activist. Which one of those do you prefer?
Well, I can't really say. If the world would go away, I would be very happy to keep to what's called my professional work, linguistics, philosophy, cognitive science, and so on, which I do find exciting, exhilarating, challenging, and demanding, and easily could easily put my full-time activities into it. On the other hand, the other activities in their own way are difficult, rewarding, complicated, also challenging, and necessary.
Again, if you've just joined us, our guest for the next 2 hours and 45 minutes, Noam Chomsky, who is now located at MIT. How long have you been there?
Almost 50 years.
What year did you go there and why?
I went there in 1955. I had been at Harvard for 4 years in a graduate fellowship and had just gotten a PhD from the University of Pennsylvania, where I actually hadn't been for 4 years. I had no recognized academic field. The work that I had was doing was didn't fit anywhere. It didn't have any academic home. And I had no particular expectations of going on into an academic career, because there didn't, for one thing, there didn't seem to be any possibilities. But I did receive an invitation from MIT to be in the electronics lab. I don't know a tape recorder from a telephone, practically, and I know nothing about electronics, but I was the electronics lab at the time was directed by Jerry Wiesner, later became Kennedy's science advisor, who was a pretty very imaginative person. The laboratory itself was a mixture of all kinds of exciting activities. A good deal of MIT at that time was in a transition from being primarily an engineering school to becoming primarily, in fact, totally a science-based university. It's a 10-year transition, which had a lot to do with things happening in American science and technology and so on. And the electronics lab where I was the center of a lot of these activities. Biology, neurophysiology, mathematics, linguistics, acoustics, just on and on. Many of these were experimental efforts. It wasn't at all clear that they were going to go anywhere. Some of them succeeded very well, others failed, but it was a great a ferment of intellectual excitement and interaction and challenge. There were other places like it at the same time, for example, Bell Laboratories. And as I was primarily in the electronics lab in a research position, but I also was asked to do some teaching. I was able to teach introductory linguistics and philosophy courses, the first ones in these areas that had been taught there. But mainly I was, my service to the university was teaching CRAM courses in French and German to graduate students who in those days had to pass a reading exam in French and German, which they considered a total waste of time because they knew they were never going to look at anything. And there was a technique for sort of getting them through the exam, essentially teaching them to fake their way through the exam, and that's the courses I was teaching for a couple of years.
On the screen is some shots of Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is on the Charles River, right across from Boston, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. How many students there, do you know?
I think there's roughly, last time I looked, it was about 4,000 undergraduates, and I think about maybe twice that many graduate students, something roughly on that order.
My background on you says that you have published 65 political books and 33 linguistic books from a total of 60 different publishers. We have been doing book shows here for many, many years. I've never heard of anybody publishing 98 books.
Well, a lot of those books are collections of talks, interviews. If you looked at the ones I actually sat down and wrote, you know, it wouldn't come to anything like that.
What was your first?
First book? The first book was called Syntactic Structures, and that was actually not intended for publication. It was notes for an undergraduate linguistics course at MIT, which at that time, this material was basically unpublishable. It did not belong in any recognized field. I had submitted a couple of articles to journals which were returned. I'd submitted a book for publication and it was MIT Press. Was returned with the sensible comment that this didn't seem to belong anywhere and I ought to wait until the field exists before trying to submit a book, which was not an unreasonable comment. It did come out 20 years later. By then, the field had been established. The first syntactic structures was actually notes, which a Dutch publisher who visited saw sitting on my desk and asked if I would put it together and let them publish it as a monograph, and they did.
What was your first political book?
First political book was American Power and the New Mandarins, which was a collection of essays, came out in 1969. It's just been reprinted. It was essays and talk, mostly a lot of them based on talks through the 1960s. Starting around 1963, I became pretty much involved in Vietnam War issues and was giving many talks, usually to audiences of two or three people. There was absolutely no interest at the time. But over the years it built up, and by the late 60s there were way more invitations and opportunities than I could take up. I was also directly involved in activism and resistance. For years, every time I came to Washington, the first thought that came to mind was the smell of tear gas. It was in and out of demonstrations, in and out of jail a number of times. The essays were a collection of, in the book, were a collection of talks, commentary, discussions based on these activities.
I have on my lap here a Norman Mailer book called The Armies of the Night. And up at the top is a picture of you back in 1967. What were you doing there at the Pentagon?
That was a big demonstration at the Pentagon in, I suppose it was October 1967, one of the first large-scale national demonstrations, not the first, but one of the biggest on a national level. Actually, Miller and I ended up in adjacent cots in a detention center somewhere after we were arrested.
Over the years, lots of controversy, lots of books. We're going to go to the phones in about 10 minutes, and they'll have a chance to deal with these. But the other book that I have in my lap, and I've got a lot of your books, is one, it's a small one. It's called 9/11, and it was a bestseller. What's your main point in this book about 9/11?
Well, that book is a collection of interviews. It's a sample of interviews, and it happens to be just those that happen to be electronically stored. So, for example, it doesn't include interviews on BBC and so on. Right after 9/11, there was a massive requests from the United States and around the world for discussion of the events, their background, what they meant, what they were going to lead to, and this is a slightly edited collection of a number of those interviews. The point was, if there is a single point, that we should be aware of the role that we play in the world. What happened on 9/11 is a horrifying atrocity. It's probably the worst single act of large-scale terror that's ever taken place. I don't think there's another single case where thousands of people were killed in one act. On the other hand, for much of the world, the response to 9/11 was welcome to the club. We've been through this, and you've often done it to us. So, for example, I've forgotten whether I quoted it in there, but the research journal of the Jesuit University in Managua, Nicaragua, which is one of the main research journals in Central America, they published an editorial immediately after 9/11, describing it, as everyone did, as a horrifying atrocity, expressing sympathy for the victims, saying you could call it Armageddon. And then they added, but we have been through our own Armageddon in slow motion under massive terrorist attack organized and directed by the United States. which led to tens of thousands of people killed and the country practically ruined and may never recover. So we do sympathize with the terrible atrocity that was carried out against you, but it's not unfamiliar to us. And that was a reaction through a good deal of the world. And that's why if you look at the... there was an international Gallup poll taken shortly after September 11th. I think it was about September 20th, or roughly in that, about a week after, asking... This was at a time when the bombing of Afghanistan had, in effect, been announced, but it had not yet been undertaken, so it was in that interim period. And the question asked around the world was... do you support, if what it said actually is, if the perpetrators of the terrorist attack are identified on that assumption, would you be in favor of bombing the place where they came from, their refuge? And then there were two questions. If it attacked only military targets, second, if it also hit civilians. It was never published in the United States, but the responses were interesting. There was very little support for the policy that was actually undertaken. And incidentally, we should say that they hadn't identified the perpetrators. But in Latin America, which is the region of most experience with U.S. domination and intervention, responses, the support was extremely low. It ranged from about 2% in support in Mexico to about 11%, I think, in Colombia and Venezuela. Now, the only marginal exception was Panama, which has an American component there. And even there, 16% supported bombing. I think 80% supported diplomatic means for efforts for extradition. And that reflects a history of experience, long experience. So, yes, all over the world there was overwhelming sympathy for the victims, horror of the terrible atrocity, but a recognition that life's more complicated. We've been on the receiving end for a long time from European imperialism, which was violent and destructive, and from the U.S. variant of it. And I think it's only... it's the nearest honesty to face this. But if we're interested in reducing the threat of terrorism, which is enormous, if you want to really be frightened, read the recent Hart Rudman study, sponsored study of the Council on Foreign Relations on terrorist threats to the United States, and they're pretty awesome. If you hope to reduce and lessen these threats, you have to make a crucial distinction between the terrorists themselves, who are carrying out criminal acts, and you treat it like criminal acts, and the reservoir of in which their concern, their message kind of resonates, even among people who hate and despise them, but nevertheless recognize some authenticity to what they say. And it's that reservoir of, you can't really call it sympathy, but understanding, where real grievances lie that have to be dealt with. That's true no matter what kind of terrorism you're facing. If you want to reduce the threat, pay attention to the grievances from which they arise, and if they're legitimate, and they often are, deal with them, for one thing, because they're legitimate. For another, because it's just sanity if you're hoping to reduce the terror. These are topics discussed in the book, interviews.
Just tuned in. Noam Chomsky is our guest, and we're going to go to the phones. We have a call from Maryville, Illinois. First up, go ahead, please.
Hello, Dr. Chomsky. I was introduced to your writings and works as an straightforward...
including the foreign policy elite at home, but there's nothing incompetent. Pat, the United States was not a major actor in the globe. Do that. There are plenty of others which are going to be well.
It's your next.
Who was a resident of Cambridge for the last 40 years of his life, was first in New York City, and was for almost 100 years connected with, very powerfully, the public affairs work of the American Tobacco Company, working with Guatemala for a war that almost was started because of bananas in the 50s, and all of these different media actions that I believe have really contributed to where we are now in our worldview of we have got a corporate mentality of destroying what we don't like, taking it over, manipulation of it, because his learning from his uncle, Sigmund Freud, was utilized to his best ability with twisting people's view of what was good for them so that he could sell products to them.
Thanks, caller. Eddie Bernays.
Actually, you're right, he lived in Cambridge. We weren't that far apart. I never actually met him. But,
called the father of public relations.
Yeah. But I've written a fair amount. I've looked at a lot of his work, and in fact have written a fair amount about it. I suspect that it wasn't his Freud who was the big influence on him, but rather, in fact, exactly what he said. He said the major influence on him was his participation in the first state propaganda agency in the United States, Woodrow Wilson's Committee on Public Information, which was established in order to try to drive a basically pacifist population into support for the war that Wilson very much wanted to get into in Europe. And it succeeded. Within a short period of time, the propaganda efforts, they were called propaganda in those days, it was more honest use of terminology, the propaganda efforts of the Committee on Public Information, a very Orwellian name, did succeed in driving a pacifist population into raving anti-German fanatics, you know, to the point where the Boston Symphony Orchestra couldn't play Beethoven, things like that. It drove the country into a kind of hysteria. And the participants in that committee included many people of subsequent great distinction and influence. Edward Bernays was one. Another was Walter Lippmann, the leading public intellectual of the 20th century and most important figure in American media. Both of them went through that experience and learned from it and wrote about what they learned from it. What they learned, as Bernays put it in a famous book of his called Propaganda, late 1920s, I think, he said that we have learned that the intelligent minorities can engineer consent through the use of manipulation, propaganda, and control. And we should do it for the benefit of the public. It's for the benefit of the public that we should control them and engineer their consent. Lippmann said pretty much the same thing. Also drawing from the experience of the wartime propaganda agency, he wrote significant, important essays on democracy in the 1920s called Progressive Essays in Democracy. They were both liberals, kind of Wilsonian progressives. He said, well, we've learned that there's a new art in the practice of democracy, the art of what he called manufacturing consent. Bernays' term was engineering of consent. And this is very significant. Because the public should not be participants in the democratic process. They should be spectators, not participants. They are ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, as he put it. And for their own benefit, we, the intelligent minority, the responsible men, must control them. Bernays's particular significance, this had all sorts of influence all over the place, in the intellectual culture, in political science, and so on. But Bernays' particular influence was exactly as you say. He was one of the founders of the modern public relations industry, which grew into a massive industry right at that period. Had it existed before, but it became very important after at this time. And its goal was to control attitudes, beliefs, to marginalize people, to induce, to drive them towards what were called the superficial things of life, like fashionable consumption, and keep them out of the public arena where they don't belong. Bernays's first major achievement was a program that convinced women to smoke cigarettes. Women didn't smoke in those days. But he had an elaborate public relations program, including models walking down Fifth Avenue, you know, to show with cigarettes showing this is what modern women are like. And it did succeed in turning women into smokers with a toll that we need not discuss. The Guatemala case, you're correct. He was the public relations. He ran the public relations for the propaganda effort to support the overthrow of the democratic government of Guatemala, which led to horrifying atrocities, which the country is still suffering from. This is one of the examples that we should be anything but proud of. And he did play a role on that. He did a lot of other things. He's famous in Cambridge for a campaign to save the sycamores on Memorial Drive, which was, again, a successful public relations campaign that many people admired.
Springfield, Massachusetts, for Noam Chomsky. Hello.
Good afternoon, Professor Chomsky. My question to you is, do you believe that a nation should suffer a detrimental cost in order to compensate for wrongs committed by the governors of that nation or by segments of that nation in the past?
I'm not sure exactly what the question means. If you're living under, let me see if I can understand it. Suppose you're living under a dictatorship, and the dictators carry out some horrendous act. So you're living in Stalinist Russia, let's say, and Stalin carries out horrible crimes. Are the people of Russia responsible for those crimes? Well, to only a very limited extent, because living under a brutal, harsh terrorist regime, there isn't very much they can do about it. There's something they could do, and to the extent that you can do something, you're responsible for what happens. Suppose you're living in a free democratic society with lots of privilege, enormous, incomparable freedoms, and the government carries out violent, brutal acts. Are you responsible for it? Yeah, a lot more responsible, because there's a lot you can do about it. And therefore, the cost of... If you share responsibility in criminal acts, you are liable for the consequences.
Jacksonville, Florida. Good afternoon.
Hi. Professor Chomsky, it's an honor to speak to you, sir. I'd like to have you address the idea of 9/11 as like a false flag or a let it happen on purpose kind of situation. I mean, it's not exactly unprecedented in American history, or world history for that matter, especially given the project for the American century, where Paul Wolfowitz said that it would take like a Pearl Harbor-like attack on America to be able to implement their plans. And could you address that for me, please?
Well, I know that's a widely held belief. Frankly, I'm personally extremely skeptical about it. I don't think there's any likelihood that an action like that could have been planned, and I don't really think there are any historical precedents for it. If the White House had been in any way involved in planning this, it would have been an act of absolute madness on their part. For one thing, you could never tell where it was going to go. For another, it would certainly have leaked. I mean, it's inconceivable that a plan of that nature wouldn't have leaked. And it just doesn't make any sense, in my opinion. And I don't think the evidence is at all compelling. I've read what there is. You're quite right about the exploitation of it. When it happened, it was exploited, not just in the United States, but all over the world. So, for example, the Russians were exploited September 11th as they saw it as a window of opportunity to step up their really brutal repression and violence in Chechnya, claiming, presenting it as a struggle against terrorism, and expecting to get authorization from the United States, the world ruler, which indeed happened. Israel used it as a window of opportunity to step up repression in the occupied territories, claiming it's a war against terror. China did the same in Western China, where they're carrying out, again, harsh repressive activities against dissident, sometimes rebel groups, again expecting U.S. authorization, which they got. All over the world, governments, including more democratic governments, used it as an opportunity to impose more discipline on their own populations. So yes, it was recognized throughout the world by state power as an opportunity to increase repressive actions that were underway or to impose discipline and so on. But that doesn't mean that all those countries planned it. They just recognized it as a window of opportunity. And I think the same was true here.
If you've just joined us, we have about 2 hours and 15 minutes to go on our in-depth program on this Sunday afternoon with Noam Chomsky. Next call, Peoria, Illinois. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to question the effectiveness of demonstrations, and especially civil disobedience, in effectively changing U.S. policy. In the Vietnam War, dragged out for 17 years, public opinion turned against the war in 1968, yet the war dragged on for 7 more years, and the opinion polls and public opinion research showed that the public, even though they hated the war, they hated the demonstrators even more. So that just prolonged the war. And like, we have a march here in Peoria, a rally against the war in Iraq. We had 200 marchers. We got 5 inches in the newspaper, 1 little inch of new information why people should be against the war. You're never going to be able to demonstrate in the street, get coverage like that, and get your message across. You had to do direct door-to-door lit dropping, literature dropping, stuffing doorknobs or canvassing door-to-door to get your message out with a full sheet of paper with all your arguments. The media is not going to do your job for you. They're not get your message across in the detail and the full expression that you'd like to see. Maybe let us, the editor, even would be more effective than the demonstration, because the demonstration is just 1 inch, and letters you just get maybe 4 or 5 inches of full explanation of what you're doing. And in Illinois, during the Vietnam War, we were much more effective in electoral politics with McCarthy and George McGovern. In fact, the Democratic Congress caucus in the House voted against funding for the war, despite the fact that McGovern lost, that McGovern had just demonstrated enough strength in election districts across the country at the grassroots level that the congressman knew that next time up they would see challenges to their congressional seats in the congressional districts where McGovern successfully elected delegates. They saw the handwriting of the war, and they voted to cut off the funds in the Democratic caucus in the House. And the day after that, Nixon signed the peace treaty and ended the war. So that was the effective way, electoral politics. But here, people, I went to a Chicago teaching for peace and justice yesterday, and they're chortling over 10,000 people blocking one street in Chicago, and they're using that as a big victory. But the government can easily use an alternative street, run tanks down the street to mow people down. That's totally a symbolic victory. These demonstrations don't accomplish anything. In Illinois, we
Pierre, I'm going to let you go. Thanks. You made your point.
One part of what you say I completely agree with. Just demonstrations, not connected with day-to-day ongoing educational and organizing activities, are pointless. Take the case of the Vietnam War, which was dragged out. In that case, I think the evidence is pretty strong that the demonstrations were very effective. They were part of exactly what you're suggesting should be done. They were part of day-to-day organizing educational activities, and the demonstrations grew out of them, stimulated other people to join, made other people understand what was happening, contributed to the activism, which ultimately, after many years, led to the appearance of political figures who were willing to become, you know, the leaders of the official leaders of what was by then a mass popular movement. And that was after years and years of very hard work, including demonstrations. And I think there's very strong evidence that they were successful. If you want to have some direct evidence for it, in 1968, after the Tet Offensive in January 1968, the business world turned strongly against the war because it was becoming very costly to the United States. It was becoming costly because Lyndon Johnson was never able to call a national mobilization of the kind that was called during the Second World War, which led to a very efficient economy. He wasn't able to do that because there was too much discontent. They had to fight what they called a guns and butter war, which led to stagflation and economic problems. The discontent was the result of activism, including demonstrations. Johnson was essentially, it was a real power play from the business world. He was essentially told to call off the war after the Tet Offensive, which indicated it was going to go on for a long time. He wanted to send 200,000 more troops to South Vietnam. The Joint Chiefs of Staff were opposed. The reason, they said, was because they thought they would need the troops for civil disorder control in the United States, where large segments of the population were just getting out of hand. Now, they mentioned women, youth, minorities, others. This is in the last part of the Pentagon Papers, worth taking a look at. The disorder and the discontent revealed themselves in many ways, demonstrations being a very visible part, but much more than that. And the appearance of politicians, Eugene McCarthy's a good case, was much later. And only when there was a mass base for it, then the politicians appeared. Not early. Before, there were a few. Grinning and Morse were two, but very few until a mass popular movement had developed. And I don't really agree with you about the demonstration. I mean, it can be, if it's not done properly, yes, it can be destructive. You can say that about anything. The demonstrations on February 15th around the world were so, they're the biggest mass demonstrations in history, I suppose. They were so significant that actually the New York Times, a little unhappily, in its comment on them, said a day after that there are now two superpowers on the planet. One is the United States, meaning the U.S. government. The other is world public opinion. Well, you know, world public opinion was visible on February 15th, and that led to the recognition that there's a powerful force there that has to be dealt with. It didn't stop this war, but, you know, there's never been protest like this against a war at that stage. You're quite correct in your account of how long it took to build up protest to the Vietnam War, which actually started in 1962. This protest was before the war had actually started. That indicates a major change in consciousness and understanding in the country, and it's the basis, I think, for developing significant popular movements which will impede and, I hope, reverse the use of violence in world domination and control. But it doesn't happen in a day. And your point about day-to-day explanation, work, leafleting, and so on is absolutely correct. Unless that's a central part of the activity, demonstrations don't mean anything.
Jerusalem, Rhode Island, good afternoon.
Hi, sir. Anti-terrorism bills were rushed through Congress in the days after the Oklahoma City bombing and have been extended since September 11th. The problem is that clearly some of those bills had been written and printed before the bombing. Already the FBI, Joint Terrorism Task Force, has issued flyers urging the public to call for information about possible terrorists, defenders of the U.S. Constitution, and those people who would make numerous references to the Constitution or attempt to police the police and lone individuals. I believe this is an undermining of basic democracy, and I believe that the FCC rule change that is proposed for June 2nd that would allow the media companies such as Clear Channel Communications to be able to purchase newspapers will limit the free press. As a novelist, I believe that you probably also support not allowing these large media companies like Clear Channel to be able to purchase newspapers on top of radio stations, since two out of every three households are reached by six major media companies. As a novelist, do you support the free press, or do you support this media rule change that that Mr. Powell, Michael Powell, who is the son of the Secretary of Defense Colin Powell for some unusual reason, but it has been alluded through Alice in Wonderland and the World Trade Center disaster, written by David Icke, what that relationship between Mr. Powell and Michael Powell and the government's hidden agenda to eliminate basic civil liberties are, do you support this media rule change by the FCC?
Thanks, caller.
Yeah. Well, on the specific question of the, you brought up many interesting points. On the specific question of the FCC ruling, I'm on your side. I don't think that, I think that the planned ruling will increase the tendency towards centralization and monopolization of media, which is a very bad thing. It's been going on for years. Quite apart from this, the major monitor of the study, which the regularly published study which deals with this, is Ben Bagdikian's book, The Media Monopoly. I think the first edition of it must have been about 20 years ago. And he then identified, if I remember correctly, about 50 major concentrations of media in the country. The last edition, which was a year or two ago, I think it was down to under 10. And the FCC ruling will reduce it even further in not in the print media, but in including the print media, in fact. And I think it's a very bad thing. We want a diverse, as diverse a press as we can get. I don't think that's the only problem with the press at all, but it's a problem. On the other issue that you raised about anti-terrorism legislation and civil liberties, here I think we have to be, we have to have a certain caution. Terrorism is a serious issue. I mean, personally, I don't object when I pass through security at the airport. I think that's, you know, you could argue about the details, but that something should be checked makes sense. On the other hand, the Justice Department, the Bush Justice Department, has claimed rights which are incredible. If they are implemented, it is a major attack on civil liberties, and to an extent they have been, and to an extent they've even been upheld by the courts. I mean, they've claimed that the executive has the right to imprison people, including citizens of the United States, to hold them without trial, without charge, without access to family and lawyers, and to do so indefinitely until the president declares that the war on terror is over, which means indefinitely. There's a new act under discussion, Patriot 2, it's sometimes called, which includes provisions that would grant the Attorney General the right to actually withdraw citizenship, rescind citizenship, on what's called inference, the Attorney General's inference from some pattern of behavior that the person supports terrorists. I mean, this is utterly outlandish. No free and democratic society should tolerate anything remotely like this. There are what's happening in Guantanamo is absolutely shocking and has been condemned by every human rights and civil rights organization throughout the world, and maybe getting worse. I don't know, can't authenticate it, but there are now reports in the British press and Australian press that there are plans for, and it's been the British Foreign Office has agreed that it's correct, that there are plans to have execution chambers in Guantanamo where people can be executed without anything remotely resembling a fair trial on charges that, and without proper legal representation or anything like that. These moves are really shocking, and we should be, you're right, that we should be deeply concerned about them. I might quote, if I can remember the wording, a comment by Winston Churchill about this. Churchill's bust is on George Bush's desk. He looks at it every day. Churchill said that something like this, to place a man in prison without charge and without the judgment of his peers in a fair trial is in the highest degree odious and the foundation of all totalitarian governments, whether Nazi or communist. Churchill said that in 1943 when he was opposing efforts to institute preventive detention for alleged intelligence purposes. And in 1943, Britain was in pretty dire straits. It was under attack by the most vicious and murderous military machine in history, and its survival was not obvious. Nevertheless, he took that position, which is correct, And he's right. What's now being proposed is, and in part implemented, is in the highest degree odious and the foundation of all totalitarian societies, whether Nazi or communist. And we should be deeply concerned about that.
Here's some of the 98 books that Noam Chomsky has published over the last, I guess what we're talking about, almost 50 years. American Power and the New Mandarins, a new foreword by Howard Zinn. This was 2002 when it came back out. There's one called World Orders, Old and New by Noam Chomsky. Remember the year this was out?
First published in 1994, and there's an expanded edition in 1996.
And here's another one, Deterring Democracy. It was a national bestseller. Can you still buy this one in the stores?
I don't know if it was a national bestseller. I doubt it.
That's what it says right up at the top.
you should know never to believe anything that's put by a publisher on a cover. That was 91, extended 92.
Most of these still in print?
Yeah.
Carlsbad, California. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Yes, sir. I'm a military officer with 25 years of experience who's read Mark Twain's War Prayer. And I got a couple of quick questions for you. And I'd like to know whether or not you think it's perfectly natural for a country to protect its borders and guard its national interests, whether they be protecting a population against terrorism or securing economic interests. And in the case of radical Islamic terrorism, that we might have had to burst the terrorist bubble in the wake of a failure of diplomacy. And that wasn't necessarily our failure, looking at their motives, intents, and consequences. And that's the first part, if I could come back to you after.
Well, should a country have a right to defend its population and its economy? Yeah, certainly. I don't think that's a question. I didn't exactly understand what you meant about the Islamic terrorism.
Well, given the war in Iraq, that we were over there perhaps in the face of radical Islamic terrorism.
No, there's no... Look, that was a fabrication. There is no evidence whatsoever. I mean, Iraq was... Saddam Hussein's a horrible monster, just as he was when he was supported by the United States, the people now in office in the 1980s. He was a hideous monster. Osama bin Laden is another hideous monster, but they're different monsters, and they hate each other. And there's no evidence whatsoever of any meaningful evidence of a connection between Saddam Hussein's horrifying regime and networks like Al-Qaeda. They despise each other and have had no known connections. The only effect of the war in Iraq on terror is that it has, as predicted, increased recruitment for Al-Qaeda. So it's increased the threat of terror, exactly as predicted by intelligence agencies in the United States and throughout the world and other specialists. But the idea that attacking Iraq had something to do with the war on terror is just mendacity.
Quick follow-up, Carlsbad.
Yes, sir. Thank you. With respect to foreign policy and the potential for peace in the Middle East, do you think that first world countries, which have a tremendous ability to provide resources and aid to developing countries, can promote peace in the face of Arab humiliation and overcome Israeli defensiveness?
Well, we have to ask. Here I think we might listen to the leading specialists on the topic, namely from Israeli intelligence. The chief of former chief of Israeli military intelligence just pointed out in a book in Hebrew that until Israel is willing to treat Arabs with respect as decent as human beings with rights, there will never be an end to terror. 20 years earlier, a former head of Israeli military intelligence, Yoshaphat Harkabi, said essentially the same thing. He said, until we deal with the legitimate grievances and demands of the Palestinian people under military occupation, there will always be the threat of terror. He was writing at a time when Israel was virtually immune from terror from within the territories. Just in the year 2000, the head of the Israeli secret police, Shabak, the General Security Services, which control the occupied territories, essentially said the same thing. He said, until we deal with the legitimate grievances and demands of the Palestinian population under occupation, we will never put an end to terror. So the humiliation is there, and the degradation is there, and the repression is there. Yes, it does lead to sometimes the terror, certainly opposition. And incidentally, if we want to look ourselves in the mirror, as we should, this goes way back. George Bush is not the first president to ask, why do they hate us? Almost 50 years ago, President Eisenhower, in internal discussions with his staff, which have since been declassified, discussed what he called the campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world, not by governments, which are on our side, but by the people. And his National Security Council gave an explanation for it. They said that there is a perception in the Arab world that the United States supports corrupt and oppressive regimes which block democracy and development, and that we do it because of our interest in controlling the oil reserves of the region. And furthermore, they said that perception is correct, so it's very difficult to counter. And they said, yes, we have to continue doing it. You hear the same feelings expressed today, even by wealthy Muslim managers of multinational corporations. They perceive the United States correctly as supporting brutal, corrupt, repressive regimes that are blocking democracy and development. And yes, that leads to antagonism and often hatred. It's not the source of Osama bin Laden, but it is the reservoir of background that the heads of Israeli military intelligence and the secret police were talking about. We have to be serious about that if you want to stop terrorism. I mean, the same is true elsewhere. Take, say, Northern Ireland. As long as the British responded to IRA terror with just escalation of violence, it increased the terror. When they came to the point of beginning to deal with the legitimate grievances, it did improve the situation enormously. It's not a utopia, but it's much better than it was 10 years ago.
Stamford, Connecticut, for Noam Chomsky. Hello.
Yes, Mr. Chomsky, I share your views and revulsion at much of U.S. foreign policy, and I think you're right. Once you understand it, it's irrefutably cruel, evil, and ruthlessly self-interested in many, many, many instances. And I find you to be an invaluable voice of criticism and dissent, yet your views are almost never appear in the mainstream media. Do you feel you're censored at some level by the mainstream organs in this country?
Well, I wouldn't call it censorship. You're right that I don't appear in the mainstream media, and not just me, but the same is true of other critical voices. The media do, in fact, reflect a pretty rigid and, I think, narrow spectrum of opinion. And if you don't belong to it, you don't appear there. It's not censorship. It's their choice and decision.
Sharon, Pennsylvania, you're on with Noam Chomsky. Good afternoon.
Yep. Good afternoon. I have some disagreement, but most agreement with you. And one of the it's in the point that I feel you don't go far enough. For instance, just on the last point, for instance, NPR. I've read that even when you're speaking to a smaller audience at American University, from which NPR broadcasts its Diane Rehm show, you've been barred from that program, even when you're very conveniently to be interviewed. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that the chairman of NPR is the former head of all CIA propaganda foreign broadcast, and the head, for instance, of PBS is the former head of Voice of America. Now, when you've got that on the supposed alternative to the corporate media, the big business media, which is interlocked and owned by military-industrial weapons manufacturers and colludes with the CIA, I think there is quite a bit of censorship. And another, I do read your stuff on ZMAG. .org, like a previous caller, and it's very useful, and I think that it doesn't go far enough in many cases. For instance, you claim that somehow it's not plausible that the administration or a faction within an intelligence supporting the administration had prior knowledge and saw that the only one that would benefit from this attack in 9/11 would be the warmongers within the Bush administration and the police state factions within the Ashcroft Justice Department. I think is belied by the fact, and this gets to the media, that James Bamford, the top NSA expert who wrote the book Body of Evidence, points out from declassified State Department and Pentagon documents that in the early 60s, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Undersecretary of Defense had plans to terror bomb American cities, murder American citizens, even bomb an American ship in Guantanamo Harbor to frame up Cuba, to blame Cuba for these U.S. Government planned bombings, and then use it as a pretext to invade. Now, there is a real precedent there. It was only called off by the Kennedy administration because apparently they figured that, you know, it might go awry. But it shows that there are these clones of this very fanatical ultra-right faction, almost duplicate at that time within the high levels of government that correspond to this Bush administration with its plans for world domination.
Thanks, caller. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chomsky.
Well, what you're referring to is Operation Northwood. It's declassified. You can read it if you like. It was a contingency plan called at the request of the Department of Defense. And it did have roughly the character you described. But if you look at contingency plans, they are all over the map. They've got plans for everything. And it was not implemented. And it wasn't the only one. There were other plans that came from the more liberal sectors of the Kennedy administration. For example, plans to stage what would look like a Cuban invasion of Haiti, which could then be used as a basis for invading Cuba. Actually, that one came from Arthur Schlesinger way over at the liberal end. But, you know, from looking at contingency plans by governments, I don't think you can conclude very much. On the 9/11 event, you have to make a distinction, crucial distinction, between two things. The earlier question, at least as I understood it, was whether the Bush administration was involved in planning it. For that, I think it's outlandish. The question you're asking is whether there could have been foreknowledge of it. Well, that's conceivable. But then we have to be a little cautious, because remember that in 1993, almost 10 years earlier, there was an attempt to blow up the World Trade Center, which came very close to succeeding. And if it had succeeded, it would have caused tens of thousands of deaths. Since that time, there was no doubt in the intelligence community that operations of this kind were possible and might take place. Whether there was any foreknowledge of this one, I haven't seen any convincing evidence of that, but it's conceivable.
In a moment, we're going to take a break, and our guest, Noam Chomsky, is a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania with a B.A., an M.A., and a Ph.D. Got out of there in 1955, has been at MIT since 55, and has published a total of 98 books over these years. You have three children, Diane, Avi, and Harry.
That's right.
Where are each of them today? What are they doing?
Avi's the oldest is teaching at Salem State College near Boston, Latin American, specialist in Latin American history, teaches history. Diane, our second daughter, is happens to be in Mexico at the moment, but is primarily living in Nicaragua, where she's been about 15 years, has her family there. Our son Harry, the third child, is living in the Bay Area, works in software engineering, that kind of thing.
We have about an hour and 45 minutes to go, and we'll be back with Noam Chomsky and more and your calls in just a moment.
about 10 years ago, the United States had the highest wages in the world, which is what you'd expect. This is the richest country in the world by far, and it has absolutely unparalleled advantages. Real wages have, in fact, stagnated or even declined for the majority of the population since their peak around 25 years ago. But in the mid-80s, the effects of the double-edged so-called conservatism of the Reaganites, namely markets for the poor and state protection for the rich, that hadn't yet had its full impact. By 1993, the impact was quite obvious. The Wall Street Journal was able to exult over what it called a welcome development of transcendent importance. Namely, U.S. labor costs had fallen below all other leading industrial powers, apart from England. We actually did fall below England for a while, but then Margaret Thatcher succeeded in driving working people and the poor down even more efficiently than us. Meanwhile, profits were rising to new heights. Earlier this year, every year, Fortune magazine has the big business magazine, has a review of the Fortune 500, the 500 top guys. And earlier this year, they reported dazzling profits, that's their word, for the 500 top corporations, even though sales were stagnating. So wages are going down, sales are stagnating, and profits are zooming to dazzling heights. Sometimes called a paradox. In fact, if you look at social policy, it's not terribly paradoxical.
Watching Professor Chomsky there from 1994, and he's here in our studios for the next 1 hour and 45 minutes, and we've got calls waiting to talk to him. This one from Omaha, Nebraska. You're on the air, Omaha. Please go ahead.
Yes, I appreciate the opportunity to ask a question. I think it's in line with what was just shown, a little talk you were giving about economics and stuff. I've been pretty deeply interested in socialism over the past 12 years. And, I keep hearing that, socialism is on the rise again in the U.S., at least within the universities and stuff. They say, oh, I see now all the faculties, out east and west are more and more socialistic. And, I guess I see as kind of the root of all the evil, all this, imperialism and capitalism, economics, creating all these, wars and terrorism, blah, blah, blah. I'd like to hear more of your commentary on, the potential or what's going on, realistically now in the U.S. and the world in terms of a true socialistic movement. In terms of like the working class really taking charge of economics potentially, rather than all this, to me, is what screwed up versions of what is called socialism, through tax cuts and blah, 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 that they're going to redistribute, that's what you get through the mainstream media, that they're going to create tax cuts and redistribute it, that's what they call socialism.
Thanks, Omaha.
Well, the tax cuts are a curious kind of socialism. I mean, the tax cuts are intended to having the effect of redistributing income even more toward the rich than is currently the case. In fact, the tax cuts are pretty clearly part of an effort to destroy the progressive legislation of the past century, including social spending in general, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, progressive taxes, and so on. That's virtually conceded. I don't know how closely you've been following the business pages in the last couple of days, but it's been revealed that the former Secretary of the Treasury, before he was fired, commissioned a study by the top government economists, Treasury Department, Bureau of the Budget, and so on, to estimate the likely effects of the Bush administration economic programs. That includes a vast increase in federal spending, primarily for the military, which means high-tech industry in general, and tax cuts directed primarily towards the most wealthy sectors, enormous tax cuts. They estimated deficits on the order of $44 trillion. Trillion dollars, that's a lot of money. That was supposed to be put into the February budget proposals, but didn't appear there. There's a debate about whether that was purposeful or not. Anyway, it's now revealed and conceded. The White House spokesperson, Ari Fleischer, was asked about it in a press conference a couple days ago, and he said, yes, the figures are correct. And then, paraphrasing him, he said something like this. He said, this means that Congress will have to be responsible in reforming Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Now, the kind of reform he's talking about is not funding it through reinstituting progressive tax measures, but basically killing it. They know that they cannot approach the population in an election on a platform saying, we're going to eliminate social spending and transfer wealth even more to the wealthy than it is today. But they can, and I think are intending, to drive the country into what a number of economists have called a fiscal train wreck, which will then have the effect of eliminating social spending. So this is about as remote from any... It's government intervention on the benefit for the benefit of the wealthy. Now, as far as socialism is concerned, that term has been so evacuated of content over the last century that it's hard even to use. I mean, the Soviet Union, for example, was called a socialist society, and it was called that by the two major propaganda operations in the world. The U.S., the Western one, and the Soviet one. They both called it socialism for opposite reasons. The West called it socialism in order to defame socialism by associating it with this miserable tyranny. The Soviet Union called it socialism in order to gain whatever, to benefit from the moral appeal that true socialism had among large parts of the general world population. But this was about as remote from socialism as you can imagine. I mean, the core notion of at least traditional socialism is that what you mentioned, that working people have to be in control of production and communities have to be in control of their own lives and so on. The Soviet Union was the exact opposite of that. Working people had no control over anything. They were virtual slaves. And the collapse of the Soviet Union is, in fact, a small victory for socialism, in my opinion. Eliminated one of the major barriers to it and should have been recognized as such. But the term has been, as I said, become so meaningless that it's hard even to use. If we use it in the traditional sense, which you brought up, that goes straight back in American history. You read the working class press in... the mid-19th century, you know, press published by artisans and what were called factory girls, young women from the farms working in the textile mills in eastern Massachusetts, which was the center of the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Their press was calling for, they said their theme was that those who work in the mills ought to own them. Wage labor, which was called wage slavery, was regarded by most Americans as not very different from slavery. Even the Republican Party regarded wage labor as just at best a preliminary to free labor, but intolerable because it's a kind of servitude. A large part of the northern population fighting the Civil War was fighting under that banner. This goes straight through the 20th century, the idea that people should be in control of their own destinies and lives, including the institutions in which they work, the communities in which they live, and so on. Call it what name you want, but that's traditional socialism. And there are today attempts to describe a kind of a detailed vision of the future based on these notions. The most extensive and detailed one I know is... by Michael Albert at Zenit, which you mentioned, participatory economics, and there are other such proposals. But I think this is deeply, you know, deeply ingrained in people's understanding and consciousness and barely below the surface. In fact, it's a call for essentially extension of democracy to the industrial sphere and to communities as well. We should also bear in mind that the leading American social philosopher, John Dewey, who's, you know, as mainstream as apple pie, his main work was concentrated on democracy. He pointed out over and over again that as long as we have what he called industrial feudalism, that is a tyrannical control, private power controlling production commerce, democracy will be very limited. We have to move to what he called industrial democracy if we hope to have significant democracy. As for politics, his position was that until that happens, politics will be the shadow cast over society by big business. And I think most of the population recognizes that and accepts it.
New York City, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yes, hello, Dr. Chomsky. I heard you refer to your early experiences with Zionism. I imagine a more universal and idealistic Zionism from that period. And I was wondering if you could speak on the evolution of your relationship with Zionism and the State of Israel. And also, perhaps if you could speak on what your vision might be for an Israel maybe drawing on that more optimistic early Zionism, and how the process of getting to that vision differs from Oslo, Clinton, and Barack in 2000, and now the roadmap.
Well, this will have to be brief, but in this book that was mentioned before, Middle East Illusions, there's a lot of discussion of that. Some of the essays there go back to over 35 years up to the present. But to try to put it briefly, when I was a Zionist youth leader, an activist back in, you know, in the 1940s. But for me, Zionism meant opposition to a Jewish state. And that was a recognized, accepted part of the Zionist movement. By no means a majority, but it was a position within what was called the Zionist movement, opposition to a Jewish state. And I think the reasons for that were good. The same reasons why I'd be opposed to a Christian state or a white state or an Islamic republic, same reasons. A state should be a state of its citizens, and not of some privileged category of its citizens. And the State of Israel, incidentally, by High Court ruling, is the state of the Jewish people in Israel and in the diaspora, but not of its citizens. And I'm opposed to that. I've always been opposed to it. So on that respect, my views haven't changed. If this was merely a matter of symbolism, it wouldn't matter much. So the fact that the United States has a day off on Sunday, okay, doesn't make it a Christian state in any sense that matters. But if there were special privileges for Christians or whites or others, it would be a different matter. Then I think we should be opposed to it, and that's true in Israel. After the establishment of the state in 1948, which the issue of the existence of Israel was essentially over as far as I'm concerned. It should have the rights of any state in the international system. I don't think states have many legitimate rights, but that's another story. But whatever rights you accord to any state in the international system, okay, Israel should have those rights. It should be democratic internally, meaning the state of its own citizens, not of the majority of them and other Jews elsewhere. After 1967, the situation changed radically. In 1967, Israel conquered the West Bank, Sinai, Gaza, and the Golan Heights. And since that time, it is now the 36th year of a quite harsh and brutal occupation, in which time Israel, when I say Israel, I mean the United States and Israel, because just about everything Israel does is by U.S. authorization and with U.S. Diplomatic, military, and economic support. They can't go much beyond what the U.S. authorizes. And what they have done is move to integrate the West Bank, particularly, into Israel to the extent that they want it. So there are massive settlement programs which have broken the West Bank into cantons, effectively. To get quickly to the Clinton-Barack programs at Camp David, they were you should take a look at the map of what was proposed. It's rather striking that while there was much talk about how magnanimous and generous the offers were, you can't find a map. I don't think a single map appeared in the American media. They were available. They were in the Israeli media and Europe, standard scholarly sources and so on. But they didn't appear. If you look at the map, you can understand exactly why the settlement was completely unacceptable to the Palestinians. It broke the West Bank into effectively four virtually separated cantons, north, central, and southern, with a little part of East Jerusalem, the center of Palestinian commercial and industrial and cultural life, separated from the three virtually. A few connections, but difficult ones. And that program that's a settlement program that was conscious, continued rapidly under Clinton and Barack. It's continuing even more under Sharon and Bush. And it is undermining the possibility of a meaningful political settlement. If you ask what the future ought to be, in my opinion, here I happen to agree with about two-thirds of the population of the United States, according to polls, and almost the entire world. There has to be a preliminary settlement on approximately the international border. It's the pre-June 67 border, with some adjustments because of changes since, but mutual adjustments. Actually, Clinton's chief negotiator, Robert Malley, discussed this in Foreign Affairs, the main establishment journal, and he said what makes sense, I think, that there have to be effectively one-to-one land swaps, which would be the basis for at least a political settlement that would lay the basis for an end to violence, a peaceful integration of Israel into the region as its leading industrial and financial center, but just part of it, without further conflict. If that stage can be reached, and there is an overwhelming international consensus on that, and strong popular support in the United States. The U.S. has been blocking that for 25 years as part of the illusions that are talked about in the title of that book. If we can get to that stage, then the further questions you're raising come up. How about there will be serious problems of democratization both in Israel and in the new Palestinian state. My own feeling remains pretty conservative. It's what it was 60 years ago, that the long term, I don't think it makes much sense to break that territory into two parts. If you know the area at all or have traveled there, you can see it's awfully artificial and harmful. In the longer term, I think there should be moved towards some kind of federal structure, ultimately as relations, improve among the people and nationalist sentiments subside and hatred subside, moves towards closer integration as circumstances permit.
We're at about the halfway point with our in-depth with Noam Chomsky. He is a professor at MIT in Cambridge. Here's a look at the outside of his office building where he works, and eventually you'll see where his office is inside. How much time do you spend there?
Usually three full days a week.
What days?
Well, for some reason, my classes for many years have been on Thursdays. So Thursdays, classes, Tuesdays and Fridays, appointments, interviews, other things.
How many classes a year or different courses a year do you teach?
Well, technically, I've been retired for the last couple of years. But this year, I had two courses at MIT and one half course at another university, State University of New York.
How much are you speaking?
I can't even remember. Almost constantly.
I mean, do you go on the road a lot still?
Quite a lot. I arrange the timing so that I can be on the road, obviously, on days when I don't have commitments at work. A fair amount.
want to take a number of calls. If you don't mind, make some notes here so we can hear some voices of people that are watching. And we'll go through a couple of these here, and then we'll come back to and have you wrap up some of the comments on their calls. New York City, next. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi, Dr. Chomsky. A couple of things, and I'll try to make this quick, but a couple of the challenges that you pointed out, the United States being the only superpower and having a much larger role and responsibility in the global community, some of the changes that need to happen, and going back to the earlier caller's points on sort of socialistic philosophy, I mean, the good for the all is the way I would look at that, it seems to almost oppose the foundation of the United States being more of a capitalistic system where it is profit-driven, and maybe I'm drawing too big of assumptions, but it seems like we're more in a plutocracy than a democracy, and a lot of the people who are in a position to make those changes on behalf of the United States also have special interests in their ears from the industrial society, or that's probably propagating a lot of the industrial feudalism, as you've mentioned, and thereby also creating some of the frustration, the antagonism, and resentment against the United States, resulting in terrorism, as we've seen it. So how do you see something like this changing when you've got sort of a disinterested public or a public that's kind of being kept out of the whole process and about to be even more so with further media consolidation? So I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on that.
We go to Fall River, Massachusetts. What your question or comment?
Yeah, Professor Chomsky, you already answered my question. But it seems to me you're really holding Israel to a double standard. You say nothing of the fact that no Jews can live in Saudi Arabia or Jordan, but you hold Israel to such a standard. And also, Jewish people cannot visit the Temple Mount. And but when Jews control religious areas, they're supposed to make it available for everybody. So could you address that? Why do you hold Israel to a double standard?
Thanks. Denver, Colorado, what do you have to say today?
Yes, hi. I just wanted to thank you very much for having Noam Chomsky on the show. This is a great honor and one of the most important writers in history. But I just want to present a hypothesis, and I would like him to address this. Do you think the recent Sharon move to refer to the O word, as people say, and what appears to be all roads leading to Tehran, as far as military action, do you think the Bantustan, you'll see the point I'm making, do you think the Bantustan model prevailed in Israel? And do you think this was an effort to sort of neutralize the Arab opposition? Because I think it appears to me that the inevitable move for military action will be against Iran, probably within the next year or so.
One last one, and then we'll come back to Dr. Chomsky. We go to Palo Alto, California.
Good morning, Professor Chomsky, or I guess it's afternoon where you are.
Yeah.
I have a couple of questions about 911, about the terrorists. The terrorists somehow prevented the U.S. Air Force jet fighters from being scrambled in the normal 10 minutes, and they caused a delay of 75 minutes for the jet fighters to be sent up. And they hit the Pentagon with a guided missile because if it had been one of those airliners, there would have been about 100,000 pounds of aluminum out on the lawn there, and that could not possibly have vaporized the way the government said it did. And somehow the terrorists arranged those cell phone calls, and that's been shown by experiment to be impossible. And somehow those terrorists put explosives in the World Trade Center buildings because Columbia University seismographs showed pulses that could only have been caused by explosives at the beginning of the fall of each of those buildings, not as they were actually falling. Now, all of these things, you can read them, for example, at cosmicpenguin.com. That has links to 55 different websites containing information about these facts.
All right, sir, thanks. There's a lot there, but yeah. Maybe you can summarize some of it.
Okay. Maybe the easiest way is to go backwards.
Fine.
That's okay. Yeah. Well, the last caller made a number of technical observations, which I'm completely incompetent to comment on. I have no idea whether there were seismographs that showed that there were explosives in the building, and frankly, I'm extremely skeptical The fact that a lot of material appears on internet sites is not very compelling. The internet is a very valuable instrument. You can learn all sorts of things from it, but anybody can put anything they like up on the internet. That's part of its value. And you have to evaluate the information. I haven't checked any of the technical issues that you discussed, so I can't comment on them, but I should say that I have extreme skepticism about them. On Sharon, Iran, the caller right before Sharon, the O word, namely occupied territories. Actually, the word he used is conquered territories, which is pretty strong and accurate. And the road to Tehran and the efforts to neutralize the Arab world. Here, I think we have to be extremely, we have to look closely. The Sharon plan and the Bush plan, as far as we have any information about them, is simply a continuation of the Bantustanization process. If you read the Israeli press, which has excellent reporters like Amira Haas and Gideon Levy, who write about this all the time, what they're describing and what you see if you go to the West Bank is just breaking it up into cantons. I mean, the separation wall, which is going from north to south, has already encircled a Palestinian town, Qalqilya, and is virtually destroying it. It was just announced that it's going to go to the east, to settlements to the east, Ariel and Emanuel. There's a story in the New York Times today about the settlement of Itamar, which is even to the east of that. Whether that'll be included in the separation wall or not, we don't know, but it's a salient, which was in the Clinton-Barack plan that basically cuts the northern sector from the rest. There is just no doubt that the separation wall or some equivalent will include the vast settlement and infrastructure programs to the east of Jerusalem, extending almost to Jericho, which cuts it again. And those cities, there's a growing city there, Ma'al al-Adumim, which was established primarily in the Clinton-Barack period, pretty much with the purpose of bisecting the West Bank. And it's got infrastructure connections to Israel, which essentially break up the Palestinian territories. That plan, as far as we know, George Bush's vision, as he calls it, as far as we know anything about it, is simply is a kind of program which is called a Bantustanization program in Israel for good reasons.
Would you say that word again?
Bantustanization.
I mean, it stands for?
That's a reference to the South African programs of the early 1960s of setting up black homelands, which were called Bantustans. Transkei was the first. There were several others. They were never recognized by anyone. But their idea was to set up black states under black leadership, surrounded by white areas. And it was one of the most grotesque efforts of the apartheid regime in its worst period. That's been regarded as a model by Israeli planners pretty openly. And it's discussed in those terms, criticized in those terms usually. But it's not unreasonable. I mean, it's a cantonization program, setting up cantons which have some connection, but not much, and are basically unviable. Is that an effort to neutralize the Arab world? Yeah, I think your suspicion is correct, but it's certainly not going to work if it's anything like that program. As for Iran being the next step, it's certainly being set up. Unfortunately, the United States is creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, it's very likely that the war in Iraq will inspire Iran to develop weapons of mass destruction. In fact, that's been predicted by intelligence agencies and analysts all over the world, including the United States, that this plan, the national security strategy, the plan to crush by force any potential challenge to U.S. domination, is virtually demanding that potential adversaries create some kind of a deterrent. And the only kind of a deterrent they have to a state with overwhelming power is either terror, which is a deterrent, or weapons of mass destruction, or, as in the case of North Korea, massed artillery aimed at Seoul and at American forces there,
which are a deterrent to attack on North Korea. But, you know, when you announce your intention to rule the world by force and to crush any potential challenge, you're virtually, you know, demanding that potential adversaries do something about it. And Iran might move on to develop weapons of mass destruction, which will then be used as a pretext for an attack. However, I personally don't think there's going to be an attack on Iran. The reason is that Iran is not like Iraq. Iraq was defenseless, completely defenseless, and that was known. And that was a prerequisite for an invasion. Iran is not defenseless. I mean, it doesn't begin to compare with the United States in power, but it's not defenseless in the sense that Iraq was. And for that reason, I suspect an attack is unlikely. On the other hand, subversion is not at all unlikely. And according to some American against democracy, he gave the model of England, and it's not going to be easy for them. They're facing harsh...
Protected.
...is from an earlier period. The two editors, Peter Mitchell and John Schuffel, did a fantastic job of, I don't know how they did it, of finding discussion transcripts, material, putting them together. They also put on the internet, there are no footnotes in the book, they put the footnotes on the internet, and it's really their footnotes. They have elaborate sources, backgrounds, extensive material. It's a terrific reference. I use it all the time.
Norton, Virginia, go ahead, please.
Good afternoon. I consider it a great honor to be able to speak with Dr. Chomsky, and I'm so impressed by what I've just heard that I have a difficult time formulating my question. What I wanted to ask about is, in his capacity as a linguist, do you think, Dr. Chomsky, that a lot of the repression and abuses of power that we're seeing going on, and terrorism included, is a fear of goddess energy? And do you know
the female?
Goddess energy.
Goddess energy. Oh, I see. I didn't hear. Yeah.
It's in regard to the Gaia hypothesis.
Yeah. Well, first of all, as a linguist, I have absolutely nothing to say about this. There's no professional, special knowledge that bears on your question. Tell you the honest truth, I don't really have anything to say about it. I'd be interested in knowing what you think.
Not there.
Since
Atlanta.
You've obviously thought about it.
Go ahead, Atlanta, you're on the air.
Hi, appreciate it. Thank you, C-SPAN. Mr. Chomsky, thank you for being on the show and doing your best to be a great American. What the founders were, in Hayek's words in Constitution of Liberty, what Hayek thought he was an old Whig, as opposed to the modified Whig that showed up in the 1830s, which was part of the manufacturing of a new sense of what we were. But in your book about Rethinking Camelot, to be a patriot rather than a court dissident, I think you have to look to the actual documents, the proof of senior Bush complicity in the CIA's assassination of President Kennedy, and to suggest that there was no change when we went back to Federal Reserve notes from Kennedy's U.S. notes, as well as the 58,000 who subsequently died in the Roman colony of Indochina, trying to preserve the interests of the 5% Catholics who own 95% of the wealth, is denying a thread in the tapestry of history that the Jews and the Gentiles that founded this country knew about, that was embodied in Jefferson's letter to Samuel Kirschbaum, identifying the real Antichrist as this engine for enslaving mankind, which is exactly who the corporations that you apparently rail against now represent around the world. I mean, this is the oil industry is Roman Catholic. Cheney and Rockefeller are merely their hired help, and the Bush family funded Hitler. That's what put him on the front of Time magazine as Man of the Year. And you, I understand your reticence to speak to the facts, but when we know we can send up a hue and cry and go after Bush for his complicity by the FBI documents, Kitchell's document of November 22nd, 1963, which you can get, and Hoover's document, which Bush denies, but which places him in the CIA a week later, as well as the court case Hunt versus Liberty Lobby, that the jury determined the CIA, in fact, committed the crime. I think a person of your stature has an obligation to the country, particularly your age, none of us got here alive, to call a spade and say what's true if we're going to be a righteous land and the land that all of our ancestors believe this country should be.
Well, I agree with you. We should call a spade and say what we think is true. In the book, most of what you talked about I don't know anything about, so I won't comment on. But the specific thing that you did raise, my book, Rethinking Camelot, I wrote it because there had just been... the State Department had just released extensive documentation about the early 1960s, a period which I'm very much interested in connection with Vietnam. It supplemented the mass of information that was already available from the Pentagon Papers and many other sources. When the Pentagon Papers came out, that was an unusually rich source because that was not declassified material. It was material that was not intended to reach the public, so it's kind of like capturing some country's archives. So that was unusually rich material. I was involved in it to some extent, and wrote about it right away. That's this book, For Reasons of State, that was mentioned, is mostly about the Pentagon Papers. The new book, Rethinking Camelot, was about this, included the subsequent documentation. In my view, I'm calling a spade the way I see it. The documentation, which is unusually rich, demonstrates as close to conclusively as you can come in matters of history, which is always uncertain, but demonstrates very persuasively that John F. Kennedy was a hawk on Vietnam. He wanted to get the troops out, but so did everyone, but only after victory. He made that very clear and explicit. There is no indication in the documentary record that I can find that he had any intention other than that. And there is furthermore no indication of any significant change after the assassination. Policy continued on course, same people directing it as under Kennedy, pretty much the same people, pursuing the same programs. As conditions changed, their tactics changed. But there's no reason that I know of to believe that he would have done any differently. And the same on other issues. The assassination was a crime and an atrocity, but the idea that there was any kind of high-level conspiracy behind it seems to me extremely unlikely on the basis of any evidence I can discover, and I've looked pretty hard.
Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. It's a pleasure to talk to you, Professor Chomsky. I agree with most of what you've said in the past and in this program as well. I have three observations to make that I've collected over the last few months, particularly after watching the media circus with regard to the Iraq war and what happened, unfortunately, after the 9/11 incidents. Firstly, my general feeling is that more and more Americans are being deluded into thinking that they are saviors of the world democracy. You know, it's a feeling, it's a prevalent feeling which is propagated by the media, as you've said before. It's just like how Britain used to say for India, you know, there's like, we are the people, we are giving the right kind of things to these people, these poor people living in their misery and in the superstition. We are the ones who are like teaching in the art of survival in this new civilized world. You know, it's like that kind of an attitude. The second thing is, one would probably think that after the 9/11, after the grievous misfortune which happened, there would be some humility and some understanding and some feeling among the public to understand the causes of what, why these things have happened. And, you know, also try to understand the sheer feeling of indignity which is felt by people from different parts of the world. But unfortunately, the public is becoming more and more paranoid and deeply mistrustful of people from, of other races within their own country because of what happened in 9/11. And the third thing is that, as far as people like you are concerned, you are one of the few people with the voice of reason which appear from time to time in different media to undo the propaganda by these mainstream media. But several times such voices like yours are hijacked by other people like radicals or rock stars or movie stars and things like that. So that all seems to undermine the credibility of the cause that we are trying to portray before America. That is, what is right? Where should people really be thinking, you know?
Well, those are good questions. They could each take an hour's discussion. On the first, Americans being deluded by the media, we have just seen a spectacular example of that, which has been discussed around the world, I should say. On last September, the campaign began about the drumbeat of war about invading Iraq. And at the same time, there was a massive government media propaganda assault, charging or at least insinuating that Iraq was an imminent threat to the security of the United States, and even that that Saddam Hussein was involved in al-Qaeda-style terrorism, that he was behind or maybe involved in 9/11 and planning future atrocities. And that had an effect. If you check the polls, very quickly, majority of the population did come to believe that Iraq is a direct threat to U.S. security. The U.S. was alone in the world in believing that Saddam Hussein was a threat. I mean, he's hated all over the place, and rightly, but not regarded as dangerous. So the countries that he invaded, Iran and Kuwait, you know, despised him, happy to see him drawn and quartered, but they didn't fear him. I mean, they knew perfectly well that Iraq was the weakest state in the region. It had been virtually disarmed. Its military expenditures were about a third of Kuwait's, which has 10% of its population. In fact, they had been moving to try to reintegrate Iraq into the general regional system, though they despised Saddam. It's only in the United States that people thought he was a threat to their security, and that was government media propaganda. The connection was with terror was completely fabricated, and it was so effective that in Bush's Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier speech, he was able to say without fear of ridicule that the victory in Iraq was a victory in the war on terror. It was quite the contrary. If anything, it increased the threat of terror by increasing recruitment for terrorist groups, as predicted by the intelligence agencies. Again, that's spectacular propaganda. As the connection with 9/11 is so such a fantasy that it's hard to discuss. You won't find an intelligence agency or serious strategic analyst in the world that gives any credibility to that. But over the months from the beginning of the propaganda campaign, a large part of the population, by now probably a majority, actually came to believe it. So, yeah, there's plenty of delusion. Your point about Britain and India is very pertinent. I suspect you're Indian, and it's pretty monstrous. I mean, the U.S. is not inventing this. It's following closely the model of other imperial powers. So when Britain crushed India, India was one of the major commercial and industrial centers of the world back in the 18th century. After 2 centuries of British rule, it had become an impoverished, mostly agricultural society. It wasn't until after Britain was expelled that India renewed its course of development, and indeed, after Britain was expelled, there were no more famines. Up through the whole British period, there were massive famines. But Britain did disregard itself, and in fact, many British still regard themselves as benefactors, as civilizers who were going to India to, you know, help the poor natives. Some of the leading British intellectuals, some of the most honorable people in modern intellectual history, people like John Stuart Mill, wrote the most outrageous nonsense about British benevolence in India and how it was there to save the barbarians and so on and so forth. So, yeah, the continental powers, if you take a look, were even worse. So, yes, this is an old story, and the U.S. is following a very familiar but extremely ugly path in this kind of self-delusion. As for the feeling among the public after 9/11, you know, it's very hard to judge public sentiments, but at least my impression is different from yours. It seems to me that 9/11 was a kind of a wake-up call for a lot of people. The United States is a very insular society. Most people don't pay much attention to what goes on outside, and in fact, people don't know much about the outside world. They don't geography, history, it's all something out there. But the impact of September 11th, part of the impact, I think, was to make people feel we better find out something about the world and our role in it and the way people feel and so on. And there was a notable increase very great increase in requests for talks and sales of books. All the small publishers started republishing books that had been out of print for years, but just because the demand grew so much. I mean, I know myself, the request for talks and discussions just skyrocketed after 9/11, and everyone else who's publicly available had the same experience. I think that was a very healthy reaction. There were also unhealthy reactions of the kind that you mentioned. They're there, too. Life's a complicated affair. But some of the reactions were healthy, sensible, and an opportunity to build on. I think a lot of the massive protest against the Iraq war, which was unprecedented, is based on that. As to the hijacking of voices, well, you know, people can do what they want. It's up to each individual, you, everyone else, to decide what makes sense and what doesn't make sense.
North Widmere, New York. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Dr. Chomsky. I'd like to ask you regarding your history with Zionism. Do you see a difference between a Jewish homeland and a Jewish state?
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, one could debate the validity of having a Jewish homeland in Palestine. That's a question, but let's accept that for the moment. The part of the Zionist movement that I belong to, and my parents as well, I should say, back in the 30s and the 40s, was committed to establishing a kind of Jewish homeland in Palestine. It's debatable, but yeah, that was my position then, still is. A Jewish state is a different matter. That's a state in fact, the groups that I was part of were calling for binational settlement in Palestine, a binational Palestine, Jewish and Palestinian Arab, with a democratic society based on, it was a socialist movement, so based on cooperative, there was a big cooperative movement, collectives and so on, efforts to integrate the general populations into it. How realistic that was, or even how valid, one can debate, but it's quite different than the notion of a Jewish state. Once the state was established in 1948, a lot of these questions became moot. And as I said before, I think the state itself should have whatever rights any state can legitimately claim. And as I mentioned, I don't think states can claim many rights, but maybe any. But whatever they have in the international system, this is one of them. But to be a Jewish state or an Islamic state or a Christian state or a white state, that's a different matter.
Madison, Wisconsin. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I wanted to follow up on a comment that Professor Chomsky made with regard to trade agreements. From what I understand, foreign corporations have even more rights in the United States than American corporations do, because the foreign corporations are entitled to sue the U.S. government for financial losses supposedly caused by American laws, say, governing discrimination in the workplace or the environment.
Well, that's not just foreign corporations. I mean, the trade laws do grant corporations rights that human beings don't have. Included among them are measures. It's a complicated matter, but there are measures which in effect allow corporations to sue governments for alleged loss of profits and so on. And some such suits have been carried out by U.S. corporations, incidentally, against Mexico, against Canada, and in principle other corporations in other countries could do that here, too. These, in my view, are completely illegitimate. You can't sue Mexico. I can't sue Mexico. But a metal-clad corporation was able to sue Mexico because they claimed that environmental laws passed by a Mexican province interfered with their right to put, I think it was a waste disposal dump there or something. And they actually won under NAFTA rules. But that's mutual. That's not just foreign corporations.
Eureka, California.
Yes, Professor Chomsky, I have a three quick questions for you. They're simple to answer. Other than voting, what can a person do? Is one thing I'd like to know about the current situation. The other thing is, other than the Constitution, what document or one book would you suggest a person read? And third, are you ever going to get your own talk show on radio?
Well, to answer the last one, no, I'm never going to have my own talk show. I couldn't handle it, and I'd never get it anyway. On the second question, I really can't mention one book that people should read. It depends on your own interests and concerns. I'm asked a lot to give people, you know, reading lists, but until, you know, the only people who can decide what they ought to read are the people themselves. They know their interests, they know their concerns, they know their degree of commitment. I mean, if you ask a question, you know, what should you read about this and that topic, I may have a suggestion. But what book should you read, I can't say. You want to know something about the history of the United States, one book I'd suggest is a book by an old close friend who was on this program just a year ago, Howard Zinn. It's People's History of the United States, which I think has just sold its millionth copy. Is a terrific introduction to the history of the United States in a way in which it is not usually taught, but should be. So that's one suggestion. As far as voting's concerned, voting is a fine thing. I'm glad we have the right to vote. But you have to have somebody to vote for. You know, there have to be issues and candidates and what are called sometimes secondary associations. That means organizations of people who press their own interests and concerns. Then voting can become meaningful. So let's say take the primary system in the United States and just ask how it works. Say New Hampshire primaries. What happens is candidates come to town and they say, here's what I stand for. Vote for me. And then they go somewhere else. The people who are listening to them probably don't believe what they're saying and have no special reason to. But that's not the way a democracy ought to function. The way a democracy ought to function is the people in the town should say, get together, discuss, work out what they think ought to happen in the country. And then they should invite people. Either they elect their own candidate, pick their own candidates, which is the best way, or if others are running for office, say, okay, come here, and we'll tell you what we think you ought to do if you're elected. If you don't want to do that, then go away. This is what we want. That would be democratic, more democratic. But until things like that happen on a very large scale, there isn't going to be a functioning democracy.
Do you vote? And
do I? I tend to vote for local candidates, and as it goes up the scale, I tend to vote less and less because I think they're less and less responsive to the population and less and more responsive to external forces. However, it varies, you know, and it's really a particular choice, case by case.
El Paso, go ahead.
Yes, Dr. Chomsky, I've been a fan of yours for many years. And regarding the last caller's questions, books that should be read, I've read a couple of interest to myself lately that I'd like to hear your comments on. One of them is Ann Coulter's book called Slander, which talks a lot about the liberal media. And I'd like to ask you what you think we in the public can do to get the media, the mainstream media, to respond and give more conservative views and more international views than we're currently being fed by the newspapers and the mainstream media broadcast. My second question has to do with the book by Joan Peters, From Time Immemorial. And I find that a very well-researched book, and I was appalled to learn of the British involvement in the state of affairs that exists now in Israel. And I was also appalled to learn of the delusions that have been passed down for apparently centuries regarding the history between the Israelis and the Arabs in what you call, you know, the Jewish homeland.
Thanks, caller.
Okay, well, the Joan Peters book, I'm sorry to say, is a hoax, which was exposed and was withdrawn from publication after exposure. And it's now come back, I'm surprised to see. When the book first came, it looks well researched on the surface.
What's the point?
The book claims that Palestinians are recent immigrants who came in after the Jewish settlement, and therefore they can sort of go home, and there's no moral issue. It has a lot of footnotes and what look like a lot of sources. It was immediately analyzed very carefully. The best work on it was done by Norman Finkelstein. You can read a detailed analysis of it in his excellent book, Image and Reality in the Israel-Palestine Conflict. But he exposed it very quickly. It was also exposed in Israel by some of the leading scholars who pointed out this nonsense. The book had a wonderful reception in the United States. The publishers then made an editorial error and allowed it to appear in England. As soon as it appeared in England, it was demolished by scholars, by journalists, by everyone. It was then kind of withdrawn here. People withdrew their support for it, and it disappeared. I'd suggest you look very carefully at the critical discussion of it before relying on what it says. As for Ann Coulter, I didn't read her book, but talk about the liberal media. It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, for one thing, the media have a... If you want to say the media are liberal, I can't disagree. I mean, so the journalists tend to support women's choice? Yeah, probably. Do they believe in civil rights? Yeah, probably. But that has almost nothing to do with the content of the media. I've written a lot about the media, but I've never talked about liberal conservative bias, because I don't think it means anything. You want to understand the media? First of all, take a look at their content. Okay, I gave one example before, the propaganda, fantastic propaganda, which managed to convince people of these incredible delusions about Iraq. It's not that the media came out and said Saddam Hussein was responsible for 9/11. But they permitted distribution of those charges uncritically in such a way that the population actually came to believe it. And there's case after case of this. Before this, earlier in the program, I mentioned that you can't find a map in the media of the Clinton-Barack offers of a settlement in Camp David, which was so highly praised. Well, I don't know if that's liberal bias or conservative bias, but it's not a journalistic integrity. If you want people to understand what this proposal was, show them a map. That's the way to decide what it was. And that was withheld. And there's case after case of this. I think there's enormous documentation of the fact, you can check it if you like, that the choice of topics, the shaping of information, the basic assumptions and so on, fall within a fairly narrow spectrum, which tend to be highly supportive of state and corporate power. I don't think it's either liberal or conservative. It's just the way things work. Some of my favorite newspapers are called very conservative. Like the news reporting in the Wall Street Journal is as good as any I know, maybe better, and it's supposed to be a conservative journal. But the question is, what is the media product? And then, if you want to understand it, you don't look at liberal and conservative, whatever they mean. You look at the institutional roots. What kind of institutions are the media? Well, turns out they're major corporations tied in with even bigger ones. Their income comes from other businesses, namely advertisers. They're basically selling a product, namely audiences, to other businesses. And I think if you look, you find that the interests and concerns of the sellers and the buyers have a very powerful influence on the media product. That has to be demonstrated, not just asserted. But that's my opinion, and as I say, I and others have written a lot about it, but I don't think it has anything to do with liberal and conservative bias.
About 30 minutes left with Noam Chomsky. Trumansburg, New York. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Dr. Chomsky, I'd like to ask you if you think that the Internet as a source of news has any chance of really breaking the deadlock that you so well spoke of in your book, Manufacturing Consent, and continue to speak about.
The Internet has been of tremendous value in education and organization, and in going around the framework of sort of doctrinal control that comes from the main institutions. That's happened here. Most of the activism of the past years has been internet-based. Take, say, the World Social Forum, which is completely without precedent. It's a huge international movement aiming at a more just, a global justice, a more just international economic and social political arrangements. 100,000 people showed up in Porto Alegre, Brazil last year, representing great numbers of people throughout the world, almost entirely through internet interactions. You can't find anything about it in the main media. The opposition to the multilateral agreement on investments, which was strong enough and powerful enough to get the powerful state, the main states, to back off from it, was internet organized. Other countries have done even more. The overthrow of the Suharto dictatorship in Indonesia was substantially based on internet communication among students and others. Not a lot of people had internet access there, but enough so that they could get around the dictatorial controls and help create a popular movement, which overthrew the dictator. In South Korea, there was just a remarkable demonstration of democracy through the internet in their last election. South Korea happens to be a very wired-up country, I think probably more than any in the world per capita. And through the internet, it was possible to develop what amounted to alternative media that broke the media monopoly, helped organize and bring people together in support of the candidate who actually won. South Korea can teach us some lessons in the way democracy should work. This was a real achievement, and it's something that is a model for others. On the other hand, we should also bear in mind that the internet is it's got many facets. It's also a method of coercion and domination. It's also a source of a lot of fantasy. You can put up anything you like on the internet. Good thing, but it has its negative aspects. You have to read what you find there with critical caution and skepticism.
Falls Church, Virginia.
Hi, my name is John from Falls Church. It's a real pleasure to talk to you, Brian and Mr. Chomsky. I've got three quick points that I'd like to comment on. One, is he familiar with the Bible code, and is there any truth to that? Two, comment on how the Republicans can take sayings like a rising tide lifts all boats and imply that tax cuts help the poor when if you really think about the analogy, you have rowboats that are owned by the yachts, and they're claiming that but when they get richer, that the rowboats are going to rise, and if the rowboats represent minimum wage, they've actually sunk. And the third is solution to Israel-Palestine, a state carved between Egypt and Israel from the Gaza Strip to the inlet on the other side, just equal amount of land from each side, from Israel and Egypt, buy out the land, and provide a Palestinian state. What do you think of that? Thank you.
Well, on the Bible code, you got to make your own judgment, but I don't put any credence in it. On the rising tide lifting all boats, that's really vulgar propaganda. I mean, it's exactly as you said. It's just the opposite. The tax cuts are targeted for the benefit of the rich overwhelmingly. Chances that it'll even stimulate the economy are very... If you want to stimulate the economy, you don't put money into the hands of the wealthiest part of the population. You put money into the hands of the poorer parts of the population who'll spend it. And that'll stimulate investment and so on. It's not a stimulus to the economy. It's a gift to the wealthy. And to call it the propaganda that's behind it is disgraceful. On Israel-Palestine... the idea of a one-to-one land swap does make sense, but if you take a look at the map, the proposal that you made isn't going to work. There's no way of making a land swap on the Egypt-Israel border that would mean anything. It wouldn't do any good for Gaza, and the main Palestinian population is in the West Bank. That's where they live. That's where they have a right to live, at least. You know, they have other claims, which they've mostly abandoned, but at least the 22% of the mandatory Palestine that is in the West Bank should be effectively theirs, maybe with some land swaps along the border. But Israel did offer a little piece of the Negev, cutting it out, as a gesture in the Clinton-Barack offers, but that was meaningless. If you looked at where it was, it didn't mean a thing.
Phoenix, go ahead, please.
Yes, I really disagree with your comment about the United States sanctioning or determining Israeli policy. It seems to me and to most Americans that with the $3 billion in aid that we give to Israel every year and the $3 billion in military dollars, and then now recently with $11 billion loan that taxpayers have agreed to, that Israel has basically got us by the short hairs. Right now with AIPAC and GINSA giving money to the congressmen, they can't turn around and vote against these things. So you have all this money that's going to Israel that turns around and gets used by the military complex to buy weapons for Israel, and United States citizens being losing control of their congressmen because if they vote against these things, then they get put like Jim Moran being ostracized for stating the truth. Then you have a situation where you have the Pentagon controlled by Wolfowitz and Pearl and Doc Zackheim, who have millions of $800 million missing in appropriations, that Americans feel helpless in terms of how money is being given to Israel, spent for the benefit of Israel, and then you say that we control Israel. I think you got it entirely backwards. Mm. I'd like your comment about that.
Yeah, well, it's a topic I've written about a lot, and I won't try to run through it. But there has been a debate for some time as to the sources of what's called U.S. support for Israel. I don't even like that phrase. I think it's very harmful to Israel. But U.S. support for Israeli expansion and militarism, that's what it is. What are the sources of that? Well, you know, one theory is what you described. It's the lobbies and the influence on Congress and so on. My view is that the record doesn't support that. What it shows, I think, and I've tried to give the evidence for this in print, is that the U.S. relationship to Israel has very closely tracked the conception of Israel as what's called a strategic asset for the United States. I can't run through the record now, but I think if you look through it, you'll find that as Israel was regarded as part of part of the U.S. system for dominating Middle East oil resources, which is the main concern, insofar it was recognized as an asset for that, connections with Israel increased. So in 1958, for example, the U.S. intelligence, for the first time, called for more support for Israel because on the grounds that, as they put it, a logical corollary of our opposition to Arab nationalism is support for Israel as a reliable base for U.S. power in the region, alongside of Turkey and at that time Iran. These are the so-called peripheral states that oppose Arab nationalism. In 1967, U.S. support for Israel shot up, but that was not because of effects on Congress. It was because Israel performed a major service to the United States. It destroyed the center of Arab nationalism, namely Nasser's Egypt, which was regarded as a threat to the oil-producing monarchies and to U.S. domination of the region. Okay, Israel wiped it out. Aid to Israel went way up. And I think the record continues like that. By now, Israel's become virtually an offshore U.S. military base. As you mentioned, a lot of the money that goes to Israel comes right back to the United States in military equipment, in high-tech industry, and by now they're just very closely integrated as highly militarized societies based on heavily on high-tech military industry. By now, Israel has military forces which, according to their own army, the IDF, the air and armored forces are larger and more advanced than those of any NATO power outside the United States, though it's a tiny country. But that's because it's effectively an offshore military base for the United States. And I think when the United States has not wanted Israel to do something and has told them so, they always back down. The lobby goes away, has little effect. But it's arguable. I mean, there's evidence on both sides, and I suggest you pursue it.
Boston, you're next.
Yes, my question is in regard to the Green Party. I understand Noam is a supporter. Would that be true? Or in general, in the 2000 election? Or?
Yeah, I'm a supporter in principle. I had my own view, if you're asking how I thought people ought to vote in the 2000 election, is that I was supported what was called at the time tactical voting. I mean, in states like Massachusetts, where the outcome was clear in advance, I think it made sense to vote for the Green Party as a way of building up an alternative and ultimately important organization in the political life of the country. In states that, if I had been voting in Florida, I would have voted against Bush because I thought there was enough of a difference between the candidates to want it not to go to Bush and the Republicans. So it's a support, but yes, mixed.
Barstow, California. You're on the air. Barstow, go ahead.
Dr. Chomsky, I wanted to ask how you can possibly turn to the UN as some source of moral authority. It seems to me I don't see how it could be regarded as anything other than a totalitarian instrument of the same corporate elites that you claim, whose interests you claim to oppose.
Well, the UN is, first of all, the UN, remember, can do nothing beyond what the great powers, primarily the United States, allow it to do. So it operates within a framework set by great power interests. Nevertheless, it does represent a wider range of interests and concerns than any particular country. I don't say it's a moral authority, and I've never called it that, the UN can become, and to some extent has been, an important and effective instrument for doing many good things in the world. It cannot do so beyond the limits of what the great powers will permit.
I have a stack of emails here, and we're running out of time. And if you don't mind keeping the answers short, I'll try to get through a bunch. Bob Feldman thought you might be interested in asking MIT Professor Chomsky, one, is it true that the 12th largest recipient of U.S. Air Force war research contracts in 1999, MIT also provides him with office space for his literary work?
I don't know if it's the 12th largest, but it's certainly a big military contractor. So, for example, in the 1960s, when I was very active against the war and involved in direct resistance, facing jail, in jail, and so on, I was actually 100% funded by the Pentagon. In fact, MIT altogether, if I remember the figures, was about 90% Pentagon funded or something like that. And it's undoubtedly still a substantial, much less than that, but a substantial military contractor. Also, there's some bookkeeping questions. So MIT administers laboratories, which are full-time Pentagon laboratories. But whether it's 12th largest or not, I can't tell you.
This is from San Francisco, and I'm sorry about the pronunciation. It's Umair, it looks like. I'm curious as to what Professor Chomsky's reaction was to hearing that President Carter was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, I don't think that the recipients of the Nobel Peace Prize is a very mixed story. In the case of Carter, what he was offered the prize for is what we should be asking about. He was primarily offered the prize because of the Camp David peace agreement in 1978, which established a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, and that was regarded as a great diplomatic triumph and so on. That's a gross misrepresentation of the facts. peace treaty was based on an offer that Egypt made in 1971. In 1971, President Sadat of Egypt offered a full peace treaty to Israel, mentioning nothing about the Palestinians, nothing about the occupied territories, full peace in return for Israeli evacuation of Egyptian territory, Sinai. Israel recognized it as a genuine peace offer, considered it, turned it down because they wanted to expand into the Sinai. The U.S. had to make a choice at that point. Egypt was, in fact, following the U.S. position, official position. The U.S. had to decide whether to persist in that or to shift it and support Israeli expansion. Henry Kissinger called for what he called stalemate, no negotiations, just reliance on force. The U.S. backed Israel's rejection of the offer. That led almost directly to the 1973 war, which was very dangerous for Israel, very destructive, almost led to a nuclear war, years of oppression, violence, and terror. Finally, in 1977 and 78, the U.S. and Israel basically accepted Sadat's original offer. I don't regard that as a diplomatic triumph. I think it was a diplomatic catastrophe.
Matthew Conover. Hi, I'm a bit of a fan of Mr. Chomsky's work since picking Necessary Illusions 5 or 6 years ago. Since then, I've read countless essays and interviews and Finding American Power and the New Mandarins rather relevant to current events. However, Mr. Chomsky makes it clear he doesn't like his personal life discussed because he disdains the cult of personality. I completely understand this, but it doesn't stop me from being curious about his life. So I was excited to read the New Yorker profile a couple of months ago. I'm just wondering if Mr. Chomsky also read it and what his thoughts are about it are.
I wouldn't comment on it, frankly, but...
Did you cooperate?
Except to advise you not to take anything in it seriously unless you can verify it independently. It's an attack on a political, hated political enemy in an attempt to discredit them. You can decide for yourself whether it's right or wrong, but just check anything verifiable.
In attack it. On you, in other
yeah.
words.
I understand what they're up to.
Did you talk to them?
I talk to anybody. You know, any journalist comes into my office, I talk to them.
McFarquhar was the woman who wrote the piece, I believe.
But that's for you to judge. Just check through anything in it that you can verify, okay, and see what you discover.
Hello, Dr. Chomsky. This is from Catherine B. King. Will you give us your severest criticism of the left as a general movement, but also as manifest in today's ethical and political situation? I think we may learn more about how to make things work from such a critique than from the current polemic with the right.
So should there be a critique of the left?
Will you give us your severest criticism of the left?
Well, you know, the left is so amorphous, I don't know what to say. I mean, there are parts of the left that I disagree with radically. There are parts of what's called the left that I support. I just don't know how to comment. I mean, there are many of the positions taken by people who are considered on the left, I think, are completely wrong, others completely right. You have to go case by case.
Jerry Stinson of Greenwich, Connecticut. 2 or 3 weeks ago, I emailed Professor Chomsky on the importance of voting George W. Bush out of office in November 2004. His courteous reply expressed agreement that this particular president should not be given an additional 4 years in office. Assuming, then, that Professor Chomsky believes President Bush is worth mobilizing voters against, I'd like to hear his reasons for believing so. To put it very simply, what's so bad about President Bush?
Well, President Bush stands for an international and a domestic policy, both of which I think are extremely dangerous. The domestic policy is what was discussed earlier, to drive the country into a fiscal train wreck through tax cuts benefiting the wealthy, which will lead to the elimination of social programs like those that Ari Fleischer mentioned, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, probably schools, others, return the population to the country to a period before the progressive legislation of the past century, which has very much improved things. I don't think it's perfect, but it's been an improvement. I think that's a disaster. internationally, the program is exactly what was stated in the National Security Strategy, a call for U.S. global domination through force, with acceptance of the right to attack anyone who might potentially challenge U.S. domination. That's outlandish. I mean, that's a call for us to be submitted to Nuremberg trials.
Greenwich, Connecticut, you're on the air.
Very ironic. That was my letter you read. If I could just ask the rest of the other question, and that is...
This is Jerry Stinson. Is this you, Jerry Stinson?
Yes.
Okay. I can get the rest of it is they're a candidate declared or undeclared, Democrat or not, who you believe offer a significant alternative to Bush and can win. Is that what you want?
That's it.
Thanks. Thank you.
Well, there are two questions. There are a significant alternative and can win. Like I think Dennis Kucinich offers a very significant alternative, but whether he can ever amass... remember, an election in the United States, unfortunately, is a media campaign, a media show, in fact, based on huge funding, primarily corporate funding. It's a public relations show, and we ought to change that, but that's the way it is. On other candidates, it's a complicated story. I won't comment.
New York City.
Dr. Chomsky, it's a privilege to speak with you. I was wondering if I could get your thoughts on the U.S.'s most recent immigration policy, where it is drastically reducing the numbers of highly skilled and professional educated workers from China, India, Pakistan, and other developing countries, ostensibly to reduce unemployment among qualified Americans. And yet, on the other hand, they're freely granting immigration and citizenship to workers from Mexico, Cuba, who are, for the most part, minimum wage earners. I was wondering if you thought there were any political as opposed to economic reasons for this.
Well, groups, Cuba is a separate case. I mean, people, the U.S. has been trying to stimulate immigration from Cuba, but that's for, because it's been trying since 1959 to bring down the Cuban government. Mexico, again, is a special case. Low-wage Mexican labor is, you know, maintains part of the lifestyle of Americans by producing extremely cheap exploited labor, which is working under inhuman conditions in the agricultural system. That's a disgrace in itself. As to keeping out more skilled workers, well, you know, that's groups that have power are going to try to protect themselves. Skilled professionals do have wield considerable power. They don't want to be, they don't want competition. What immigration policy should be like is another question altogether. I mean, if we believed in free trade, if anybody believed in free trade, they would accept Adam Smith's principle that free trade is based on free distribution of labor, free movement of labor, and not just free movement of capital. Is that a correct policy? Well, probably not, because there are a lot of other issues that conflict with it about, you know, maintaining national cultures and all sorts of other things. So I think it's not easy to state generally what an immigration policy should be like, but the reasons for the choices that you're pointing to, I think, are reasonably clear.
I know you said we should make up our own mind on the New Yorker article, but there's a couple of paragraphs I want to read and ask you about.
Okay.
It has to do with your wife, who is with you today, Carol.
Ask her if she's
in the other room. How many years have you been married?
Since 1949.
Carol shares her husband's views and has been politically involved herself, but she dislikes the activist existence even more than he does. My life has certainly not turned out the way I expected, she said. To me, the interesting question is, if I were in the position of making the choice to marry now, would I choose him? She went on. That's a funny question. Who knows? I mean, it's very different from what I expected, just in terms of the fame and notoriety and whatever you call it, the intrusion of public life, the ridiculous clutching at him, the noblesse oblige aspect. Sometimes he says, I just have to take that call. We've actually got it now so that the phone almost never rings, except when it rings at 3 a.m. from some party where kids are having an ecstasy rave or who knows what.
Well,
is that in context?
Very much out of context and selected in order to present a certain impression. I mean, some of the words may be accurate, but that's the reporter's goal, is to present a certain picture. You can ask my wife how she thinks about that.
It's too bad we have more time. We get her out of here. El Cajon, California, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Dr. Chomsky, I'm wondering if you might comment on the failure to find the weapons of mass destruction that were supposedly held by Iraq and the implications that would have for the United States and in the world if no such weapons are found. Thank you.
Well, there's out in the rest of the world, it's a big issue. In England, it's leading to major attacks on the government. The former Foreign Secretary Robin Cook just had a long, sharp critique of the government for simply lying to the public. The position of the British government was very simple and straightforward.
You know that Mr. Blair said today that he's going to lay out the information which will show that they have found weapons of mass destruction.
Okay, I haven't seen that, yeah. But up till now, they have not presented any meaningful evidence. Frankly, I'm surprised. I mean, I would be very surprised if you couldn't find some evidence that Iraq was producing biological and chemical weapons. My suspicion is if you, 40 miles from Washington last week, someone found, anthrax and other bacteria that had been left over from some program, presumably terminated, so they claim. And you're certainly going to find that somewhere or other. But the failure to find the weapons of mass destruction that were claimed and the undermining of specific claims has been pretty remarkable. You'll recall that Colin Powell's position and the official government position here was his words, the single issue is will Iraq disarm? If that was the single issue and you can't find weapons of mass destruction, that means plenty of fabrication. And in fact, the intelligence community itself is up in arms about this.
We got one call left, yeah. And we're finished. Noonan, Georgia, go ahead, please.
Noam, I was wondering if you had any thoughts on the late John Rawls' theory of justice.
Thanks. We've just got a minute.
Yeah. Well, he's an extraordinarily important philosopher and a wonderful person. I knew him. It's a tremendously important book. It revitalized political philosophy in the 20th century.
Your immediate future? You're here in Washington to do something later today?
I got a talk, as usual, this afternoon. Back to Boston. More talks. More.
Next book?
Writing a book. Middle of a book. Almost finishing a book right now.
When will it be out?
As soon as I find enough scattered moments here and there to put in the final pieces of it.
You're 74.
In the fall, I hope.
You're 74 years old?
Yep, coming up to 75.
Plan to retire anytime soon from all of this?
Formally, I retired a couple of years ago, but that's formal, just bookkeeping changes. No, I don't see any major changes in the future.
If you've just joined us, we've had 3 hours with Dr. Noam Chomsky. He's based at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. A native of Philadelphia, a graduate of University of Pennsylvania, 1949, got his MA there in 51 and his PhD in 55, and has published 98 books in his life. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks to our audience. Have a good day.